On April the 16th at 2 p.m. North American Eastern Time, blind musicians from across the globe are getting together for an online benefit concert for Ukraine. It's called We're With You, and all money raised goes to the World Blind Union's Unity Fund for Ukraine. To learn more, including how to listen and how to perform at We're With You, visit mushroomfm.com/withyou. That's mushroomfm.com/withyou.
AccessCast, an Accessibility initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibility and the author of the number one New York Times best-selling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibility. That's ACCESSIBE. Visit www.accessibility.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Hi, thanks for joining us on another episode of Unstoppable Mindset. We're glad you're here, and we hope that you'll find our presentations today interesting. We have a fun guest, I think, in a lot of ways. I won't reveal it all, but I'll just tell you that he's been a software engineer. He's been a blogger. He's been on some podcasts. He's a runner, he's a meditator, and he loves the ocean. And we'll get into all of that today as we get a chance to talk to Matt. So Matt Rock, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset.
Thank you. Very, very happy to be here.
Well, we're glad you're here. So tell me a little bit about kind of your early years. You know, you grew up in the Dana Point, Southern California area. Can't argue with that as a place to grow up, but you know what... Tell us a little bit about you earlier.
Well, like you said, I grew up, San Juan Capistrano, went to high school, Dana Hills High School, so which is in Dana Point, and grew up at the beach. So the beach was really kind of a place where I spent my my summers. You know, back when I was 12 years old, back in those days, your parents would drop you off, or you would ride your bike to the beach, you know, and you'd spend all day there by yourselves, you know, or with your other 12-year-old friends. You know, today it sounds crazy like that you would do that, but it's a different world back then. And the summertime, you know, pretty much, you know, was all day at the beach. We'd go we'd go boogie boarding, you know, later on in junior high and early high school, I got into surfing. We'd go, you know, if the visibility in the water was good, we'd go spear fishing. Really a great place to grow up. You know, it's funny, like, as I grew older, kind of later in the high school, I kind of went through this phase just a bunch of bourgeois, you know, rich folks, you know, live here. There's nothing really fun and exciting to do. You know, certainly things must be more exciting in other parts of the world. And then as you become an adult and you mature, you realize, you know what? It wasn't so bad back then, you know, back there. There's something to be said for, you know, for that ocean. And pretty much covers my life back then.
So when you went to the ocean, boys and girls?
Yeah, I mean, for me, there absolutely are boys and girls at the ocean of all ages. But you know, my friends
were guys.
We're all guys. Yeah. We're just all go surfing or whatever. But
so then you went off to college. Where'd you do that?
Oh boy. Where did I not do that? So
one of those deals.
Yes, I was on the 10-year plan. So like, as you mentioned, you know, I'm a software engineer now. I don't think I ever took a software course in college. So I started off as a religious studies major. You know, that's a topic that continues to be very interesting to me. So, you know, back to my child, you know, I was raised in a kind of a Christian conservative evangelical home. You know, at the point when I went into college, you know, I wanted to go, you know, I initially wanted to go into the ministry. So I was a religious studies major at Cal State Fullerton, went to Biola University eventually. And there I kind of, I guess you could say, you know, quote unquote, lost my faith. Just kind of had some kind of existential questions, so to speak, about all that, you know, kind of burned that all to the ground. So I took a break from school after Biola, and then I went to UC Santa Barbara a few years later, spent several quarters there, got burnt out, took another couple years off. And then finally I just said, you know, I've got to get this thing done. Like, I've got to get my bachelor's, because I was under this impression that I've since have come to learn that it wasn't necessarily true. But, you know, I think most of us kind of grow up like, you know, you have to get your college degree, otherwise, you know, you'll end up, you know, eating on the street somewhere. And so I was living in San Francisco at the time, and the University of San Francisco had this program kind of geared towards people that worked. Basically, it was the easiest way I could think of to get my degree. So I got my degree in organizational behavior, which I honestly had zero interest in that degree. I do not encourage people to go out and get degrees of which they have zero interest in. The funny thing is, you know, so we're living in San Francisco, and this is right, like, this is the late 90s. So it's right around that first dot-com bubble, when it was still about, you know, before it burst. And I'm living off of $7 an hour, and I'm seeing people my age doing quite well for themselves, thinking, maybe there's something, you know, maybe that wouldn't be such a bad idea to get into those computers. And back in junior high, I was super into computers. So I learned on the Apple II, and I had an Atari 800, you know, so for those that are into computers and are about, you know, in their 50s, like myself, you know, we'll remember those. So that's exactly what I did. I like got into it and just serendipitously kind of made my way. And, you know, here I am, I'm a, you know, principal engineer for a company that used to be based out of Seattle, but we got acquired by a company out in the Boston area. Fairly decent career for myself. So
when you were doing the early computers, did you ever see any of the old Tandy or Radio Shack computers?
Oh yeah, absolutely, man. You know, like, you know, like when I grew up in San Juan, you know, we had a, you know, like everybody else, we had a Radio Shack in our town. I'd ride my bike down there. I would just like gawk at that, you know, at that RS. What was it? The RS or the TRS 80? Yeah.
80. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Oh yeah, the old Commodores. Yeah,
K-Pro, which was in San Diego. Of course, that came out, and which was sort of the equivalent of the IBM XT, or actually more the AT, with K-Pro. I owned a company for a while, and we sold as the basis of what we did a lot of the K-Pro machines, and now all that's gone away.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. It's a totally different world. Now we have this thing called the internet.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah.
Well, I got to ask, this just popped into my brain. So you went and did a lot of swimming back in the days when you were 12 and 13 and all that, and seemed to be pretty fearless about it. Nowadays, we see a lot more of shark attacks and all that sort of stuff. The question is, is it really more now than there used to be because they're hungrier and they discovered that we taste good? Or is it just that the media is covering it a lot more and there really still isn't that much more than there ever was?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I've never like actually researched it, but even back then, you know, like, like the movie, like remember the movie Jaws?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, that came out, what was it, like in the early 70s? And
right.
I have an uncle that today, he still talks about that movie and says he's never going in the ocean, you know? So I tend to think that it was kind of the same back then as it was today. You know, I mean, basically, you know, you step in the ocean and your chances are going to be greater than 0% that you're going to run into a shark, but
right.
Very, you know, very low. Of course, you know, it does depend on, you know, some, you know, there are some areas that have more than others. You know, here in Dana Point, there have been more sightings like down in the San Clemente area, which is just south of us, and yeah. San Diego County, which is the next county south. We're in Orange County. You know, I've heard it also said that people are more surprised about how few shark attacks there are based on just how many sharks there are in the ocean and how many people there are swimming. You know, the fact of the matter is, for the most part, sharks just, they're not interested in us. Like, we're not good food. And most of the attacks you hear about, from what I understand, like, I'm not an expert on this, but from what I understand, are from juvenile sharks that basically don't know any better and are more curious. I'm not sure if there's necessarily like more now than there was when I was younger, but I tend to think that there's not.
Well, the world does change. You mentioned Orange County. Go find an orange tree in Orange County today.
Yeah.
When I was a student at UC Irvine, we, through a friend, discovered a packing house up in Orange, actually, ironically. We could go up and buy 20, 25 pounds of oranges in this big box for like $3. And yeah. Of course, finding oranges in Orange County today, fresh and on trees, not there.
Well, yeah, you mentioned to me before the recording that you went to school in UCI in Irvine. And I remember you drive through Irvine on the 5 freeway and plenty of orange trees back, you know, back when yeah. I was like 7. You know, it's so like, you know, 45 years ago, but yeah, not so much today.
No,
a lot of concrete.
The first time we went to Disneyland, we were living in Palmdale, and you drove down through the Angeles Crest Highway, and you drove down into Los Angeles and out of Los Angeles. And then you were in this tunnel of vegetation, trees and so on. And suddenly you came out into this little oasis that was Disneyland, and it was all vegetation and not built up. Now it's all built, and it's, they say it's progress, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah.
So what kind of software things do you do?
So, I am in what's called the configuration management space, or also what's known as kind of the DevOps space, that are in my space to be familiar with that. So that's essentially where developers meet to operations. So we create software, I guess you could call it, you know, automation software. So if you're a company that has, you know, thousands of servers and you need a way to make all of those servers, you know, look a certain way, and you don't have, you know, 1,000 engineers to spend hours on each individual servers, we write software that that helps to automate that process. That basically says, hey, we've got 1,000 servers that are going to check in to this particular, you know, kind of master server and say, you know, we want to look like this, you know, make us look like this. And that's exactly what happens. So,
do you ever in your work, this deviates from what you're probably normally asked, but do you in your work ever get asked or find requirements to deal with accessibility, so that as you're making sure that machines look the same or behave the same and so on, that you do something to build accessibility in for, say, blind people who use screen readers, to make sure that when they look the same, they look the same to everyone so that everyone can use them? Do you ever encounter that?
You know, at one point in my career, I did a lot more kind of web type of development. And there, you know, there were certain things that, you know, appealed to, you know, that we tried to make more accessible, not quite to the extent, you know, surprisingly, not quite to the extent that, that you're talking about. So, because they were somewhat smaller, they were somewhat smaller web operations, and mm-hmm. you know, the audiences that we were catering to, just, you know, it wasn't like, you know, mass consumer audience where there would be, you know, a lot of disabled individuals, you know, in that population. Not saying that there wouldn't be any in the populations that we were facing. What I do today, there may very well be, like, some of our customers may be using our software in such a way to ensure that, you know, certain settings and so forth on their servers do accommodate, you know, those with accessibility issues. But as far as me personally and the work that I do, I'm working at kind of like a very kind of a low level. Kind of a, more of a, what you would call a systems engineering level. And so accessibility concerns don't come into my purview too often, to be honest.
Yeah. It's a tough thing because mostly we still don't see the industry, the technology industry, making products inclusive. And it's not just for consumers, but it's also for the potential employees who might work at a company that that things become usable, that there just isn't a trend still. And it's difficult because we're just not a priority that people have recognized yet. And ironically, the other side of that is something that I actually had a discussion about with someone recently on another episode of Unstoppable Mindset, which is that if you work to make products or your company available to and inclusive to all persons, including those with disabilities, what statistics, and there's a lot of hard evidence to show this, what you will find is that employees, like blind employees who you hire, who can use your products on the job and do the work that you want them to do, will tend to be a whole lot more loyal, will work a lot harder because we know how hard it is to get a job.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and we just don't see that people are breaking through that barrier yet because there's still so much fear surrounding the whole concept of disability, you know, which is a term everybody just still feels if you are a person with a disability, you're just not able. We've been able to warp so many other words. So, you know, hopefully one of these days people will break through and recognize that disability isn't really what they think it is. But, you know, it's kind of one of those things.
Yeah, I mean, I have a huge amount of respect for you know, especially somebody that's visually impaired, you know, in my industry, because it is not, you know, like it's not friendly to that demographic by any means. And, you know, the technology has definitely come a lot. You know, there's with screen readers and so forth. But like, I've heard some of these screen readers, and like, I just can't imagine having to you know work with that. It just you know, because it reads literally everything on your screen, and you don't need to read everything on your screen, but it doesn't know. At least the ones that I've
well, but the reality with screen readers is that the good ones have built in a lot of features and a lot of control so that you can skip around to different parts of a screen. You can move not linearly necessarily at all, although linear is the most common way, where you just arrow through line by line, but you don't need to do that anymore. It is a whole lot different, but it used to be that way where you didn't have a lot of control. But today the reality is that we can zoom around a screen, pardon the pun for Zoom, but we can zoom around a screen just as well as the next person. What we don't get is a lot of the graphical information necessarily as easily. Even so, that's getting to be better, and will evolve over time. But it is getting there.
Interesting.
But yeah, screen readers are really devices that have come a long way, and also Because the information is readily available. Some people, and I do myself, use Braille displays, refreshable Braille displays. Unfortunately, they're still only kind of one or two lines long, but still you can use refreshable Braille displays and actually present the information in Braille, which in a lot of ways is preferable because it's quieter. Although I use earphones, so people don't hear it anyway, but it's quieter. Again, as displays advance, we'll be able to actually show graphics on them, which is cool. I'm actually working with a company helping to create a way to display graphics in Braille, which will be cool.
Wow, that is super cool.
So it's a lot of fun, you know. We'll see where it all goes. But you do software stuff, and then there's the rest of your day. So
that's right.
I'd love to hear more about you and the ocean and kind of what you do, because sharks or not, it is still something that most of us don't do. I tend not to be much of an ocean swimmer. I've been in the ocean and I've played in the ocean some, but it isn't normally what I do. But it's not so much out of fear as it is just, that's just not what I do.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And you have to be like, for me, you know, I live 10 minutes away, so it's convenient. You know, I can make it part of my, you know, weekly exercise regimen. Whereas, you know, if you're, you know, the further, you know, there's only so many, you know, there's only so many coastlines, you know, in the world. So,
yeah. there are. So tell us a little bit more about what you do.
Yeah. So I, for the last, it'll be 2 years this May. I swim about 1.75 mile. I guess you could call it a route. It's you know, there's not much of a route to it when you're swimming along the coast. But I do that about four days a week.
It probably isn't really fair to say your route is fluid. Oh, anyway, go ahead.
All right. And so yeah, I do that about 4 days a week, year round. I don't wear a wetsuit. And so, you know, this time of year, well, you know, we just had a heat wave down here. So yeah. that got things, you know, almost to 60 degrees, you know, here in February. But typically it's around like, you know, 55 probably at the lowest, probably averages around 57 degrees. So it's a little, it's a little cool, but I've found it to be actually an amazing, I guess you could say an amazing teacher. So that's essentially what I do. I sometimes used to do it, you know, first thing in the morning. Lately I've got this 7:30 meeting that I have every morning, so I can't do that. So I do it kind of, it's a nice way to break up the day, you know. So it's about a two hours from the time I leave my house to the time I get back, you know, when you account for driving time, takes about 15 minutes to get from the parking lot to the beach, at the beach that I go to. But it's just been, yeah, it started around COVID, you know, just after COVID. So before COVID, running still is a very big part of my my physical exercise, but I was really into, I would do a fair amount of weightlifting, you know, mainly to avoid injury from running. And so after COVID, when the gym shut down, like I was missing that that full body, you know, workout. And so, you know, one day it was like, you know, it was late May. I was noticing that in the newspaper that the water was about 68 degrees, which is pretty comfortable. And I was listening to this podcast about a free diver. So free diving is basically the sport that people that will dive to like these amazing depths with no you know, no scuba gear. So it just kind of got me into this mood. It was a warm day, and just thought, you know what, I'm 10 minutes away from that ocean, and I felt like there was this tractor beam, you know, out there like drawing me out. So I had some errands I had to run in the morning, And then that afternoon, like, I didn't even have a bathing suit, like, that, you know, fit me properly. And so I just parked my car, you know, put some shorts on. And I didn't swim very far that day, but just like, I was hooked. Yeah, it was just, just an incredible experience. Just getting in to the water, you know, it was 68 degrees, at least, so the paper said it was 68 degrees. And sometimes, you know, you got to take what the paper says with a bit of a grain of salt. So I would say it was probably more towards like the 65, 64-ish. And so, you know, after doing this a couple of years, you become accustomed to like degree by degree almost what the water's like. But like when I got out of that water that day, I just felt like this amazing feeling, like just, you know, it's almost like just a rush, and just felt so kind of just in tune with nature, and just really became something that like I really want to do this tomorrow. And then I wanted to do it then, you know, a couple of days after that. And so I've just been doing that ever since.
So what's the water temperature when it was like 68 or 65, depending on who you believe, what would the water temperature be?
Oh, so, you know, so this was late May. So, in the, you know, from I would say April, so surprisingly, all the way through, and, you know, it fluctuates, but all the way through could be early November, the water will stay in the, you know, in the mid 60s. Now at the high of the summer, you know, it can get up, it can get down here, it can get as warm as the mid 70s. That doesn't it might not last for incredibly long. And there's even periods of the summer, like it's July, where it can dip down to the low 60s. We have this thing called upwelling, where basically it's caused by the wind. And so you get the wind that pushes the water that's deep, you know, up towards the surface, and the water can get a lot colder and sometimes that'll last for about a week or so. But
so I see it's about 54 degrees in Dana Point right now, according to my little Echo device. What would the water temperature be this time of year?
That's about, so we just
about the same.
So I'm sure that sounds probably about accurate. I mean, that's at the cold end. And we just had these winds. So
it's pretty cold right now in Southern California in general. The grapevine going up Northern California is all closed. We've got, they originally forecasted in Big Bear, which is about 40 miles from us, 3 to 5 inches. And now they're saying 8 to 12 inches of snow today. So it's pretty cold.
Yeah. So basically when the days get shorter, you've got more, you know, nighttime, you know, more time of cooler temperatures. Right now you've got this wind, which just really can make things a lot colder. So what'll happen, so it's 54 today, let's say, in a week, you know, so we've on the forecast, we've got some 70 degree weather forecasted for early next week. I'm pretty sure a week like 58, 59. And then magically, so I've only been doing this for a couple of years, so I'm still learning like what the patterns are like. But last year, I can tell you, like the last few days of March, it's like springtime has come. Suddenly, things are changing and moving in the right direction. In those last few days, it starts pushing over 60. And for me, like, you know, after you've been doing this for a while, you know, your body does kind of, like my body is much more, you know, accustomed to it now than when I first started. So once it goes over that 60 degree mark, you know, it might be on the cooler side, but there's this threshold, you know, the further you get away from 60 degrees, you know, the further north of 60 you get, the more comfortable it gets, the more better it feels. But once you dip below 60, at least for me, it's like it is a different kind of a different ball game. And which you especially notice when you get out of the water. You know, I can certainly talk more about just that whole experience of cold water swimming, because it's a whole kind of phenomenon in my mind unto itself.
How so?
Well, so when you know, when you get in the water, I guess the best way that I can put it is, it's like, first of all, you know, when you get below that 60 degree level, there's just like this, oh my God, the water is so cold. And so you have to kind of come up with a way of, okay, so how am I going to approach this? And when I first started swimming, you know, so I started swimming in the springtime, you know, the summer, and, you know, over that summer and over the course of those several months, I really gained this love of swimming. And I was thinking, well, so what am I going to do in the wintertime when it gets super cold? And most of the people that I saw swimming, you know, even the summertime are wearing wetsuits. But to me, there is a certain visceral, I guess you could say, intimacy that I feel, you know, when I'm with, you know, I like feeling it on my skin. And so I'm wondering, you know, like, you know, first of all, when's it going to get cold and how am I going to react to it getting cold? The one thing that around October, it was still warm. And I saw this documentary, you know, some of your listeners may, it's rather popular. It was on Netflix. It was called My Octopus Teacher. And it's about this this diver based in South Africa. And his water temperature was in the 40s, and all he was wearing was a hood. So he wasn't wearing, you know, that was the only neoprene that he had on him. And so I'm looking at that and just thinking, well, wait a second, it's not going to get that cold. He's alive, you know? So I guess it's possible, because to me, like here in Dana Point, even in the summertime, the surfers all were full wetsuits. Yeah. A lot of the swimmers were wetsuits. In my mind, I'm just thinking, like, is this even possible? Is it even healthy? Like, can you even survive out there? And so, you know, I saw that. I did a little bit of research on it, and based on the research I did, I'm like, oh, you certainly can. Of course, you know, you always have to be careful. You always have to be aware of your limits. So eventually, November came. First storm came with the water temperatures plummeted. So the first day I went out there, and it was about 57, 55. And it was just like, I don't know how to describe it. It was like a different kind of cold. But, you know, as you're in there, it's odd to say, but there's not a sensation of suffering per se. I guess that's the best way I can put it. So when you take that initial plunge, and what you really need to do when you're doing it, as I've discovered having done this, is you can't resist it. So you can't go out there just saying, you know, oh my God, it's so cold. Like, that feeling of like, I just want it to be warmer. I want this cold to go away. Like, you have to accept the cold. You have to have a curiosity of the cold and allow yourself to really feel to really feel the cold. And when you do that, this is my personal experience. When you do that, you realize that it's not plunging you into this abyss of suffering like you think that it would. As a matter of fact, you feel incredibly alive. And there'll be days where I'll go to the beach and I'll kind of feel like I'm in the doldrums, and, you know, might have, you know, just like a tad bit of, you know, just feeling down. When I take that plunge into the water, it just shocks me. And my whole mindset just shifts, and what's interesting is, as I'm walking, so what's worse, I'll tell you what's worse than the cold, it's the anticipation of the cold. So as I'm walking to the beach from the parking lot, I am feeling this dread, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I just got out of this warm bed, I've got my sweatshirt on now, and I'm not feeling too bad. Why in the world would I want to, you know, take this sweatshirt off, you know, and with just my bathing suit, get into that cold water? Like, how could that be a good idea? And first of all, I have to remember, okay, at this point, I've done this hundreds of times. And of those hundreds of times, have I ever gotten into that water and felt like, oh my God, this is horrible. I want to get out of there. No, I haven't. In fact, I felt that pretty much zero times. And the thing that you have to, that I've learned that you have to deal with that voice of fear as a friend. You can't push it away. And what I'll tell myself is, you know what? I don't have anything to prove. This isn't a macho type of a thing where I'm out there to prove that I can go swim in cold water. This is something that I'm doing, you know, for myself. If I get out into that water and I feel horrible, or I feel, you know, there's, you know, I can get right out of the water. You know, I have the freedom to do that. You know, I can make the choice. I can turn around, I can go back, I can dry off, and I can go home. You know, that's totally cool. But here's the thing: the second I take that plunge into the water, I've never felt that. Over time, I've gotten used to it, and it used to be kind of like, oh, I can get into this cold water, but now it just comes so natural to me. And it, you know, I walk down that trail to the beach. I acknowledge that voice that says, you know, this is nuts. I don't want to do this. You know, I acknowledge the presence of that voice, and but I'm committed to getting in there, and at least getting in. And you put your backpack down. You take your sweatshirt off. You put it in the backpack. You turn around. You face that water. You walk. You focus on your breath, and you just let the water come, and then you take that dive. And yes, you feel cold, but because you feel cold doesn't mean you feel bad. You really have to kind of approach it. You know, you have to be receptive to the cold. You know, so just allow yourself to feel the cold, to feel the power of that cold. And it's like the best way I could describe it is it's like a portal. So as you walk out, you're walking out into the ocean, and you've got the troubles of life and or the fear of the cold. You take that first plunge, under that wave, and you come up, you are in a totally different mindset. Your whole mindset has changed, and you are, I am ready to swim. And within, seconds, or certainly a couple minutes, my whole, so your body does go through a physiological change. So when you're in cold water like this, what'll happen is your blood goes away from your extremities, away from your skin, and towards your core, because your body, at this point, your body's number one goal is to keep your internal organs warm, at a warmer temperature. And so as that's happening, physiologically, you're going into a whole different mode. 5 minutes into a swim, I actually feel great, from a temperature point of view. It sounds super odd, but I do not, after about 5 minutes, I do not feel cold. I'm in the water for an hour, and after that first 30 or 40 minutes, the cold does start to creep in. So the last 20 minutes is, honestly, it's the last 20 minutes, the hardest part of the swim. Your fingers start to feel a little like you have a hard time getting your fingers to come together. But even there, it's interesting. There's kind of certain psychological things that I've learned. And the first thing is to be calm. So as that cold is creeping in, you're thinking, oh my God, I'm going to catch hypothermia. Oh my God, I'm going to die. Or this is bad, great. Here I am, a husband, I'm a father, this is the most irresponsible thing, I'm going to end up, people are going to come. And suddenly you notice all these voices are in your head telling you about all these horrible things are going to happen. And you have to make a choice to hush those voices. And when you do that, you realize, things really aren't that, things are not that bad. And I don't want to, because hypothermia is real, and it is a risk when you go into the cold water, and every person is different. and different beaches have different risks. So I don't want to at all minimize and say, oh, you know, it's okay. You know, you're always going to be safe. You know, as we talked before, you know, there are sharks. You know, the chances are super, super, super small that you're going to get, but like, yeah, like the chances are greater than 0% that you will see a shark. I've never seen one.
But look at all of this, you know, what you're talking about. You know, we call this test the unstoppable mindset. And you have talked all along here about your mindset, the mindset that you have adopted, that you've learned to adopt. And yeah, even after 40 minutes or so, your body temperature clearly is dropping. You're getting messages about that. But even then, with the fear, your mindset has taught you how to take control of that fear and be able to step back and you start to see, well, maybe it's time to start wrapping this up here fairly soon, because you know what to do. But you have adopted a mindset, you've created a mindset that allows you to deal with all of these conditions and not do anything too stupid or too funny.
Right, exactly. And, you know, on this whole time, you know, I'm less than 100 feet out. So I have the ability to swim in. I've actually, when it got cold, I did change kind of the way that I now go to the middle of the beach and I swim to one end and then all the way down to the other end and back. So at a certain point, I have the ability to bail. So if I get too cold, right, I give myself kind of that out. And I've only taken myself up on that four times, and none of those times have been because I was too cold. It's because like I was time constrained or whatever. But
so does your wife ever go swimming with you?
No. So it's definitely not for everyone. But there's definitely, you know, there are other people that do this that, you know, I see other people out there, and it always surprises me why more people don't do it, because it really is just such an, when you are out there at 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, or 6:30 in the morning, especially, you know, the sun has just come up. I mean, you just see the most amazing things. You're out there by yourself, the horizon, it becomes like this incredible shade of like kind of purple, pink. You see the moon up in the distance. I'll be swimming and I'll see a school of pelicans, you know, just swoop down. I've seen dolphins. I've had a dolphin swim, you know, literally swim around me. I've seen seals. I've seen a seal come right up to my face and swim with me for a period of time. I've seen, you know, schools of fish. And it's just such an amazing experience.
Have you met a whale yet?
No, but about 3 weeks ago, I was in Hawaii, and, you know, I'm in Hawaii, so I'm going to swim every single day. And right now is humpback whale season. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't see any like when I was out in the water, but it's when you dive, you can hear them. And that was just mm-hmm. that was amazing. Like, so you dive down, you can hear, it sounds like a baby crying, was the first kind of thing that I could think of. But that was pretty neat.
It's got to be a lot of fun and fascinating just to see all these creatures out in the sea. And as you said, have a seal come up and look at your nose and follow you around and the dolphins and so on. You know, and you're right. Not everyone will do this and not everyone is cut out to do it, I suppose. But by the same token, it's still all about adopting mindsets. You know, you asked me earlier before we started this about me living in New York, and I mentioned being in the World Trade Center. And the story that I've been telling people for a little bit now, because I finally kind of figured it out, was that when the airplane hit the building, it hit 18 floors above us on the other side of the building. And for me, I didn't become fearful. What happened was that I had spent a lot of time prior to September 11th, 2001, learning the complex, learning what all the rules and regulations were for evacuation procedures and such. and learning every single thing that I could. And partly I did it, well, mainly I did it because I was in charge of an office. So I ran that facility and I needed to be able to function like I viewed everyone else who functioned as a leader of an office. Yeah. Now, in reality, I think that I took it a step further than a lot of people do, but I wanted to be able to be as capable, as independent, as sufficient, and as resourceful as any leader in any office in the World Trade Center could be. So that meant I needed to know stuff. I couldn't be led around. I had to be independent and be able to walk where I wanted to go. If we were going out with customers, I needed to know where to go. And I needed to know where to go so that I could take people where they wanted to go or where we wanted to go if we wanted to go out to lunch or whatever. So yeah. It was important for me to do that. But having learned all of that and thinking almost every day when I went into the World Trade Center, anything else new to learn today, or do I need to check anything out again? And being alert like that developed the same kind of mindset. So I knew how to control fear. That doesn't mean I wasn't afraid.
Right.
And on September 11th, it doesn't mean, and you know very well, you're seeing it and you're saying it. You don't need to, you're not going to be afraid, but it doesn't mean that you're not fearful and you're not totally unafraid. But what you know how to do is to control your fear, because you adopt a mindset.
Right. And it's not a way of controlling your fear because you've defeated your fear, or you've tackled your fear, but you've met your fear and you've acknowledged your fear, and you've acknowledged that part of yourself is okay. And you know what? It's healthy to be fearful sometimes. So if you're out there in the water and a shark comes, like, that's a healthy fear. I have read, like, what do you do if it's, and one of the things it says is to fight back. And so I hope to never be in that situation.
But sure.
Fear is teaching us something. And sometimes, our minds can allow, fear and other emotions to definitely to get the better of us. But yet one thing that this has all taught me or helped me to learn is that by kind of acknowledging that, not resisting it, but accepting it as part of yourself and just observing, just simply observing it and it can help you to kind of realize that it's not the best way I could say is that it's not the truth. So when you go out there in the water and you think, like I said, it's the anticipation of the cold, the fear of the cold, that's worse than the cold itself. Yeah. And the irony is that you get all this, you've got this fear, oh my God, it's going to be horrible. This water's going to be cold. But the reality is, when you go out there and you have the experience ends up being great. And so, every single time as I'm going into this experience, walking down to the beach, when the water is 54 degrees, thinking, what the heck am I doing? I know I'm going to have an experience out there, and that experience is going to be a good experience. Now, some days are tougher than others, sure, but that carries out outside of the water. In our daily lives,
sure.
We're met with stress, from all sorts of angles. And the great thing about swimming is that I'm putting myself basically in a controlled, stressful, I control the stress. So I know that I'm going out into the stressful, I'm putting my body into stress. But when I'm in situations in real life, in situations outside of the water, in my daily life, where I don't have so much control of the stress, it really does, it helps to meet that, that type of stress, having, kind of gone through that controlled stress.
Right. You learn how to deal with stress. You learn how to be able to self-analyze or step back, even if it's an instantaneous process, and go, wait a minute,
yep.
What is it why am I really stressed today? And maybe sometimes there's a reason that subconsciously you sense for being stressed, but you can stop and take a look at that and go, oh, here's the deal, and then be able to move on, because you again have adopted a mindset that says you don't have to be paralyzed or blinded by your fear. You can move on with it and you can deal with it.
Right. That's absolutely right. And what I find interesting, particularly with cold water, is so like, you know, mindfulness or meditation, you know, a lot of these concepts have become, you know, popular, being aware of your stress, being aware of your feelings, and they're great. You know, it's fantastic. But sometimes it takes a long time to kind of train your mind to not become so identified with your feelings. But when you're in the cold water, so all these in the cold water, that is something very visceral. And when that cold comes on you, like that's something that you can feel, right now, and there is no mistaking, where that cold is. And as I interact with that cold, and I develop a curiosity about the cold, and sometimes I'm out there, I'm like, am I suffering? You know, is this difficult? And I'll stop myself. I'll think like, let's just really take some time and feel the cold. Like that's something that you can feel. You know, sometimes it's harder in a more of a classical kind of a meditation type of a, even though those are great environments, but there's something I've learned with the cold is like, this is like, it really kind of brings us all into a more kind of a tangible level.
Has meditation helped you in developing this mindset, or maybe a better general question is, how has meditation helped you?
I would say absolutely yes. Yes and yes. it's helped me in with this, and it's helped me in general. So I started meditating, like 20. So I started meditating 20 years ago, and I probably meditated for a good 5-6 years until I stopped. I started meditating in the Zen Buddhist tradition. So I lived in San Francisco at the time, was very close to the San Francisco Zen Center. And so would go to the morning meditations almost every morning. It was an incredible experience for me. So like I mentioned earlier, I kind of came from a more of a conservative evangelical background, and having kind of at one point basically jettisoned that background, it kind of put me into this spiritual vacuum. So I needed, what Zen Buddhism really gave me was, it gave me something to do. And that something to do became meditation, and it became very, very helpful. And it gave me all of that within a framework that I didn't have to like believe anything that I felt was suspect, which is something at that point in my life I really needed. So it was just something, it was extremely helpful. It was extremely challenging. But there was something about it that I just really believe like there is something here for me, and I'm willing to, those of us that have been meditating for any period of time, you learn that you're not sitting on a meditation cushion blissing out. You know, what you're doing is you're sitting down, you're thinking about like what you're going to do later in the day, what you did yesterday. Each of those thoughts is an opportunity to see, I am not that thought. That thought doesn't define me. That thought is something that's happening inside of me. It's something that I can watch and about myself, but it doesn't necessarily need to govern what I do or how I feel. I think as we grow and we mature along those lines, that becomes a good kind of growth trajectory for us. So eventually I stopped meditating and became a kind of a workaholic. And about 5 years ago, my life was kind of going in a direction where I didn't like the direction it was going in. I felt like I was just kind of losing touch with who I was, with what I wanted to do. I was working for the sake of work. I was losing my ability to just like kind of feel human, so to speak. And eventually I just said, you know, I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to stop working to the point where every single night I'm going to bed with my laptop, you know, on my pillow, and eating horribly, not exercising, because I think I just need to work. And so I stopped that. I stopped eating better. It's funny. There was like, I basically, the best way I could describe it is that there was this voice in my heart talking to me, and I was ignoring it for a long time. And I would get still, and I would just sense, you know what? I need to start taking better care of myself. And I started listening to that, and everything just started very slowly and gradually to just turn around. And so shortly after that, I started meditating again. And it was very, it just opened my mind to all sorts of, you know, it just allowed me to see things in a different, from a different perspective, and allowed me to see that, you know, all these things I was chasing with work that I thought was gonna, you know, be the be all and end all of where I needed to be, just, you know, wasn't. And I just needed to be quiet and to focus on what's around me, and allow kind of life to carry me where it sees fit to put me.
When I took a course in transcendental meditation many years ago, back in the UC Irvine days, one of the things that they said was, if you're really deeply meditating, you may come up with bright ideas. You may come up with a lot of thoughts and so on. Don't act on them. Let yourself meditate until you're ready to come out. And you'll find that the things that you need to deal with are still there. And what you should do is to really just let your mind flow freely. And again, it's not the bliss type of thing that, as you said, it's not. It's more of you're really letting yourself be connected with your subconscious and all of you connecting with each other and giving you a better perspective on how to move forward during the day.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, we want to, like, you know, tackle life and, you know, figure things out. And I think a lot of that's part of the barrier with meditation. Like, we think we're going to sit there and we're going to figure out our problems, you know, or we're going to be given some oracle of, like, this is, you know, the way that you should live your life. And no, you know, it's much more subtle. Mm-hmm. But it's learning, right, just to watch those thoughts, you know, watch what's coming into your mind. And what comes into your mind, you know, they're like clouds, and they are not your identity. And as you open yourself up, you become open to intuition, to just things pop into your head. And as you allow yourself to become observant of that and not get so rushed into, like, what's happening right now, or what's this thing that I want to do, allow your mind to settle down and, like, maybe think, okay, it's okay if I don't figure this all out right now. Or if it's okay, that I don't reach the outcome that I think is just so important. It's okay if I open myself up to thinking to the possibility that maybe what I need the most that's out there, I have no idea what that is now. But if I kind of open myself and give myself the intent of, you know what, I'm just going to live my life the best I can. I'm going to be open. I'm going to let myself kind of to listen what life is telling me. And as you learn to follow those cues, you find yourself exactly where you need to be at that, you know, at that time. I don't want to paint too rosy a picture, because sure, life is difficult, and we have, you know, difficult things come our way, and sometimes, you know, traumatic things, you know, happen to us and we don't understand why. So like you say, having this mind, you know, this mindset of, you know, observing what happens to us and being open. So that's what, like, with the water, to me, one of the biggest things that it's taught me is to be open. As I walk into that water, not to resist the cold, but to be open to the cold, to be receptive to the cold. You know, maybe the ocean wants to give me something and I don't know what it is, but I'm going to be open to that. And as I walk away from the beach after my swim, you know, I walk away with a gift. likewise in life. So
what would you advise others, or how would you advise others? We've been talking about a lot of things with mindsets and so on, and you clearly have a very, I would say, unstoppable positive mindset about a lot of things. But what kind of advice do you want to leave our listeners with as we go forward?
I guess so. So first of all, from the point, like, so if you're interested in, like, I would love to see more people at the beach, you know, doing the same thing that I'm doing. Obviously, you know, nobody wants to see crowds, but I'm not really worried about that. I don't think that's going to become a problem. No. You know, with I want to make sure that I don't leave this by kind of giving a little bit of advice to somebody that's like, hey, that sounds kind of interesting, swimming at the beach. So my advice to that person would be, one, start when I started, like, you know, like in that springtime, you know, start when it's warm, start when it's the most, you know, honestly palatable to you. Go to a beach that you feel comfortable with. So the beach that I go to, I've been going to since I was born, really. My mom was body surfing at this beach when she was pregnant with me the night before she went into labor. So the history of me, so I feel very comfortable. You know, go find a group to swim with, and so just let yourself go out there and do it, and you know, and hopefully you'll enjoy it, you'll love it, and you'll wanna you'll wanna keep doing it. For the rest, you know, like we said, like there's only so much coastline. Some of us just don't live. It's just not practical, right? Like if you live in Nevada, there's not a lot of beach. You know, some people might have lakes and there's, you know, that's all great too. But, yeah, as, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, about meditation. I've found that to be very helpful. There's tons of books and resources out there, you know, on meditation, on mindfulness that, you know, I would encourage you to look up.
Do you have any favorites?
I'm trying to think, boy. I should have come more prepared. So, you know, Jon Kabat-Zinn is a great resource, and he has kind of a lot of stuff. Like, you know, a lot of people think, you know, especially like if you're not like me, you don't come from a religious background, and religious terminology just is a real turnoff to you. Jon Kabat-Zinn, you know, really has a good way of approaching, you know, mindfulness as, you know, like this is something that's a tool set that anybody can have that doesn't have to be steeped in any kind of, you know, religious or, you know, supernaturally type of language. You know, it's something very practical and very down to earth.
I think it's Dan Harris, 10% Happier.
I've heard of that, yeah, but no, yeah. I haven't read that. Have you read that?
Yeah, and I would certainly urge people to consider reading that as one book that talks about meditation, and it's his life journey as well. But again, it's not religion. It is really all about dealing with mindset, dealing with mindfulness in a sense of connecting with yourself. It's a really good positive book that is an easy read and something that people can, I think, find helpful if they're willing or interested to explore it. It's another way to go.
Cool. Yeah. I'll have to check that out myself. Yeah, I've seen it on my Audible. Yeah. I'm a big Audible fan, and it comes up on my feed every once in a while. I'm like, oh, I should check that out.
You can get Thunderdog on Audible, by the way.
You know, I was seeing that today, as a matter of fact. You know, the thing that one of the things I love about Audible is I like reading things that are read by the author. And, of course I read a ton of stuff that's not read by the author. But you just, you know, sometimes, especially if it's not like a novel, I really like it to be read by the author. But at any rate, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for being on Unstoppable Mindset today. And I think you've offered people a lot of useful information and some good advice, and love the stories that you told. Do you have a way, if people want to reach out to you, that they can maybe communicate with you and learn more from you and explore more of what you do?
Yeah. So on Twitter, I'm MROCKX, MWROCKX. I have a blog that I blog occasionally. I used to blog very regularly, you know, as a technical blog, you know, for computer type stuff. But the last few years, I blog more about the type of stuff that you and I have talked about, and that's at mrockx.medium.com. You'll see all everything.
Do that once more.
Mrockx, mrockx.medium.com.
Okay.
So that's where you'll find kind of more of my non-technical. So in fact, if you Google open water swimming in Dana Point, you're likely to come upon a blog post that I wrote where I talk about this whole experience, which is called A Year of Open Water Swimming in Dana Point. And then you'll hit some of my other stuff.
You should write a book about it.
Maybe someday.
If people want to email you, is there an email address or can they contact you through
Yeah, it's matt@mattrock.com. And just always remember my last name starts with a W. So I was originally Matt Wright and my wife her name was Mock. So we combined the names into Rock. So it's Matt, cool. matt@mattrock.com if you want to email me.
That's great. Well, Matt, thank you very much for letting us have a chance to meet you and learn from you. And I hope people do learn and will take a lot of what you said to heart, because I think you offer some great advice.
That was a super fun conversation, Michael. I really appreciate that.
We need to do it some more. Maybe one of these days you can take a little computer out in the water with you and we can talk to you while you're swimming, you know.
That doesn't sound safe.
I know. Well, thanks very much. And if as you people are listening, we'd love you to give a 5-star rating for our podcast today, wherever you're hearing podcasts. If you'd like to reach out to me, I would appreciate hearing from you. You can reach me at Michael H-I, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-H-I at Accessibe, A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E.com. And we'd love to hear your comments and thoughts. And Matt, for you and anyone who's listening, if you can think of other people that we ought to talk with, I would appreciate any suggestions or connections.
All right, will do.
Well, thanks very much. And for all of you, we'll see you next time on Unstoppable Mindset.
You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.